From Aspen Public Radio, it's Valley Roundup. I'm your host, Wyatt Orme. This week, a judge in Glenwood Springs says there's enough evidence to try the couple accused of stealing more than $1 million from the ranch they manage for more than 3 decades. Also, the interested parties seem to agree on where a new Lift 1A on Aspen Mountain should go. And we'll talk about how some events this coming summer have a little bit of a social justice feel. All that coming up on Valley Roundup. I'm joined in the studio by Curtis Wackerly. He's the editor-in-chief of the Aspen Daily News. Hello, Curtis.
Hi, Wyatt.
We also have Aspen Public Radio's very own arts and culture reporter, Kristen Kay. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, Wyatt.
And on the phone, we have Tatiana Flowers. She's a new reporter for the Glenwood Springs Post-Independent. Hi, Tatiana, and welcome to the Roaring Fork Valley.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Can we start? Will you tell us just a little bit about yourself? Where were you before coming to Glenwood Springs?
Sure. I'm originally from New York. I was born and raised there. And then I think after being there for 24 years, I got tired of it.
Uh-huh.
It's, of course, a bustling city. I lived about 15 minutes north of Manhattan. I went to grad school in Times Square. So I was, even though it was a small city that I lived in, it still felt like I was living in the big city. And so then I moved to Denver without a job. I just did it. And uh-huh. Looking back at it now, I don't regret it, but it was really a bold move. And then I got a job a month later at the Associated Press, the Associated Press's Denver Bureau. I had spent 6 months there working as a multimedia temp. And then after that ended, I got a job at the Glenwood Springs Post-Independent covering crime, court, health, and education.
Wow. So you went from like one of the biggest cities in the United States to a bigger city in the United States to Glenwood Springs?
Correct.
Quite a change?
Pretty much, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, very much a change.
What are your impressions so far of the Roaring Fork Valley?
I like it so far. It's different, and that's like what I was going for. I think my biggest hope was to just stay in journalism and have a full-time staff position, which is really hard to do nowadays.
Right.
I didn't really as much care where I ended up. I just really, really wanted to be reporting, and I'm still at the beginning of my career, and I just thought that having full-time opportunity would help me grow the fastest. I think people here are a lot nicer. I'm sure that goes without saying. A lot more friendly. When I first got here, people would say hi and like ask me how my day was, and I wasn't used to that. I kind of thought they were a little bit weird. but there's no shortage of stories here.
Yeah.
It's definitely a smaller feel. But I think, you know, I think there's stories everywhere.
Yeah.
No matter if you're in a small area or a big area.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's been great. It's beautiful. There's open blue skies, big sun every day, dry. So no day is a bad hair day. So it's different, but I like it.
Nice. Yeah. Well, let's get to some of the reporting you've done thus far. You reported earlier this week, you reported on the case of Zane and Charla Ferris. They were accused of stealing more than $1 million from a ranch that they managed in Newcastle for over 3 decades. So who are the Ferrises? Who are they working for? Give us a sort of a lay of the land.
Sure. So I think it was almost 30 years. It was like 29 years or something, but it's basically 30 years. They were working on Bear Walla Ranch. It's in Newcastle, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. and Mrs. Ferris were the managers. She was to be in charge of the bookkeeping, so managing the company's expenses, and he was to be in charge of the day-to-day operations, so managing livestock, overseeing other employees, making sure they were doing what they were supposed to do. The owners of the ranch are Joe and Fran Rogers. They also own Waffle House.
Which is a restaurant chain in the Southeast, right?
Right. I think I'm probably going to get this wrong, but I think there are like 195 Waffle Houses across the United States, so it's not like a small chain or anything like that. So they had used Bear Walla Ranch for like their social gatherings, and I think from my understanding, as Waffle House grew, they decided that the ranch couldn't, you know, contain all of the social gatherings they had, like the size was too small. So they kind of downsized and stopped having the social gatherings there and just had the Ferrises stay and manage the livestock part of the ranch, like the animals and all of that. So they were barely there. They pretty much relied on the Ferrises to make sure everything was running smoothly from that end. And the contention is that they stole more than $1 million from the ranch while they were there.
And you name yep. some pretty interesting things that they like. One of the things you mentioned is they paid themselves additional, or they're at least accused mm-hmm. of having paid themselves additional salaries. What are some of the other things that they allegedly sure. kind of did?
So, not to cut you off. So the list goes on. Kind of, there are a lot of allegations. It's not a technical case, but there's so many facts, or so many allegations rather. The Farrises and their children are involved, and it seems like Mrs. Farris was in control of most of the embezzlements, and she was the bookkeeper. So, yeah, she would allegedly miscode check. That's what they called it in court, which means that she would write, in the company system, that she'd write a check for a certain amount to a certain company, when really she would write the check for a different, usually a higher amount, to another unauthorized company. And I think the owner said often that a lot of the people she would actually write the checks to, they were friends or family or people they knew, or it was for their benefit for their own ranch. They also said that the Farrises would, pay themselves extra salary and their kids extra salaries for work that they never did. They said that they took food, coffee, tools, they stole animals, took a lot of the expense reports off the ranch when they were terminated so that the owners wouldn't be able to do much investigation on where the money actually went. They bought themselves an extra home.
Wow.
I think it was almost $1 million. So, the contention is that it's more than $1 million that they stole, and that's just all they could really prove. I think they cut it down to 7 years of investigation because they said there was just so much what mm-hmm. they call proof
mm-hmm.
That they just couldn't, manpower, they didn't have enough manpower, and their owners of the ranch are not investigators,
right?
They said that they just basically that they just stole a lot from the time that they started, probably until
what tipped the owners off? It sort of sounds like they must have been doing this, if it is indeed true that they did this for years and years and years. How did the owners sort of first catch wind of this?
So I believe it was in 2016. I meant to check last night, and then I forgot. So definitely, I think, in the article that I wrote. But I believe in 2016, Mrs. Farris asked for more money than she should have needed. This is what the owners say. They say Joe Rogers, he said he had just deposited $50,000 into the Barawallo checking account, and that should have been more than enough money to manage the ranch at the time. And Charla asked for more money. I'm not sure for what, they didn't really specify, but he said that that's when he started to realize that something might have been wrong. And so he started asking her for, copies of checks and mm-hmm. the access to QuickBooks, which is the
and
system
counting
that
software.
She used to manage everything. And then he said that he and his wife spent tons of hours looking through, and that's when they started to see all of the widespread death.
Yeah. So last question, do the Farrises have any defense that you got a sense for?
Yeah, so they both had lawyers. She had a different lawyer than he did. Although there was a lot of proof, I did note that his lawyer called up a certified public accountant. I think she's like a forensic CPA,
mm-hmm.
And she had her look at all of the checks, the same evidence that the investigator collected, and the woman said that she found no evidence of widespread theft.
Hmm.
So that was one that was the defense's, I think, most interesting call to the stand.
Yeah.
And then her lawyer, Mrs. Farris's lawyer, basically said that the investigator relied solely on Mr. and Mrs. Rogers, the owners, for the proof, and that she didn't really go to any of the vendors that allegedly received the fraudulent money.
So, I see.
For me, those seem like the most important things that they pointed out.
Yeah.
But after the preliminary hearing yesterday, her lawyer came up to me and said that she would continue to vigorously defend herself because they didn't feel like it was fair to move it to trial.
Okay. Well, great. Well, we will continue to look for your reporting on this as it proceeds. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Thank you. This is Aspen Public Radio. You're listening to Valley Roundup, a look at the week's news with reporters right here in the Valley. Putting things in perspective for us today are Tatiana Flowers with the Glenwood Springs Post-Independent, Curtis Wackerly, editor-in-chief of the Aspen Daily News, and Aspen Public Radio's very own Kristen Kay. So, Curtis, you had a big story this week about Lift One. Can you tell us what happened, and can you tell us why it's important?
We had a major breakthrough in discussions on redevelopment and creating an improved ski portal to Aspen Mountain in the Lift One section of town, South Aspen Street, west side of Aspen Mountain. And this has been something that has been on my radar as a reporter in this town for basically a dozen years. There's been numerous proposals that have come up, that have been shot down, that have been debated endlessly. And they have all included replacing this this older chairlift. It's called Lift 1A on the west side of Aspen Mountain, sort of where replace it in its existing location, which you get on the lift. It's at the top of a big hill, so it's not particularly accessible from town. Mm-hmm. That may not sound like a huge deal on its face, but I think to people who are really passionate about Aspen Mountain and about skiing, the notion of when you rebuild that lift, have it actually start three blocks down the hill, basically in the downtown core, which it's important to note is where the original 1947 chairlift, which was the first chairlift on Aspen Mountain, it started in that location. So
this
had,
is like going back to the original design.
Right, going back to the original design of the mountain, the original mountain portal. There's been a lot of, just to be able to recreate that, would be appealing in a number of ways for the connection to our history, but really just for the practical purpose of now all of a sudden you basically just took an entire neighborhood of town and made it ski in, ski out, which is nice. yeah. You're improving public access. I mean, it's a little funny to talk about public access to Aspen Mountain when, you know, a season pass cost $1,400 and this and that, but
and pretty much like all the other lifts and the gondola couldn't be more accessible. I mean,
but here's what it's important, because the reason we're talking about this is that there are two massive land use applications for new hotels that are going to go in on that street. So that three blocks now that you walk up to Lift 1A, there's not much going on there. You know, there's some rundown buildings. There's stuff that's been torn down, and what's going to happen is there's going to be almost 200,000 square feet of development, 160 hotel rooms. There's going to be massive development going on there. So it's going to have this feel of an even more sort of private enclave.
Right.
And so by bringing the lift down the hill past those hotels, it really changes the picture than if the lift was starting where it is now. And so what happened on Friday, this has been basically for the last year, the city has brought in this outside consultant who's an expert in ski area design. And the reason this has been so tough is because you have the two developers of the hotels. You have the city that owns significant parkland in the area. You have the Aspen Skiing Company, which doesn't really own the land below where the current chairlift is, but obviously has an interest in all this. So you have you have these four disparate parties that oftentimes have very competing interests. And no one could get on the same page for a long time. The two developers were at each other's throats 2 years ago, accusing each other publicly of not being on the up and up with the public.
Wanted the lift to go down?
Yeah, well,
right?
the developer at the top, you know, people sort of assumed they wanted the lift on their property.
Yeah,
people started putting the pressure on them to work, work with all the parties to figure out a way to bring it down. I mean, that's a gross simplification of the matter. But basically, it looked like their land use application may not get approved unless they at least made a concerted effort to try and see if they could bring it down. So they bring in this consultant. They work on this for a year, pretty much behind the scenes. And then on Friday, they came out with their study with the recommendation to bring the lift lower, and everyone was in agreement. They had achieved consensus.
Wow. Okay.
Which everyone just, you know, it was just one of those moments where like, wow, you know, that's not a story you hear too often, that that everyone worked together and got along and worked it out and we're in a better place.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things.
One of those rare sort of local news stories.
It's a land use unicorn. And so that announcement was made on Friday. And then we had our first public meeting on this stuff on Tuesday, which were really surprisingly well attended. They had an open house on at noon where the public was invited to come in and look at the designs and talk to the people who were involved. And, you know, it went on for almost 2 hours. I mean, and it was, there were people in and out the whole time. The city council convened at 4 o'clock, spent 3 hours talking about it. There was, you know, there was this kind of kumbaya moment of, oh, everyone got together. But the reality of the situation is that we're really just beginning, and there's a lot of work to be done. There's going to have to be as many as 3 ballot questions that the public is going to have to approve for this to become a reality.
And why, I don't mean to ask an ignorant question, but why does the public need to decide this? Like, why is it a
matter of a
vote?
Well, there's 2 main reasons. So, like I said, this involves city parkland. The city has parks that are sort of interspersed in all these properties. And per the city's charter, if you change the use of a city park, you can't do that. If the city wants to do that, they have to get the public's permission. So it's kind of designed to protect parkland, to protect open space. If someone comes and says, hey, I want to build a strip mall on this open space, they can't do that without getting the public's vote.
Gotcha. Makes sense.
And so this, you know, the city has basically said, well, yeah, I mean, it's you're not giving away the park, but you are putting commercial ski area infrastructure on it. There's going to be a chairlift in the middle of a city park. So that does enough to change the use of the park. They have to go to the public and ask the public's permission. The other reason why we're looking at a potential vote is that this required some compromise from the hotel developers. They have to go and tweak their plans to basically create enough room to run a chairlift up the middle of their sites.
So like in between these two developments, right?
Yes.
There's sort of these two hotels and this is going to split the difference.
This is going to go right up the middle of them. And it's literally going to go in between two buildings on one of these hotels, which they have to kind of go back to the drawing board. And they're going to come back with an amendment to their plan, which is already approved. And it's probably going to require some height and mass that's over the zoning limits. And and we have a new land use policy in Aspen that was put into our city charter by the voters in 2015, which requires the a public vote, an election, to approve any variance over zoning codes.
Wow.
Something we have here in Aspen.
Okay.
And this would actually be the first time that has been put to the test where you have a vote on a variance under this particular charter amendment.
Wow.
So it's all very interesting to me as someone who's been watching it for a long time.
Are they trying to get this on the November ballot?
That's the goal. That they have to do a lot of work between now and then, because as I mentioned, we have to they have to make amendments to these land use proposals.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what those are yet.
Wow.
I think at best we'll see those in a couple of weeks. And even that's an aggressive schedule. I mean, this stuff tends to take a lot of time.
Right.
And so to try and rush us through to the point where if it's going to be on the November ballot, you have to have the ballot language written, you know, sent into the clerk's office by first week of September.
Yeah.
So time is definitely of the essence. It already came up at the meeting on Tuesday that maybe that's a little, maybe that's not realistic, because no one wants to, you know, try and do too much too fast and in the process kind of screw up what otherwise is maybe a viable option. So there's already been some talk of holding a special election in January.
Do you have a sense, Curtis, of like what the debate is going to be like when this does come to public vote? I mean, is this going to be a bloodbath, or do you think this will be supported by voters?
I think people will be inclined to support it just because we've talked so long about how this lift can't come down the hill. And now that there's a plan on the table to do this thing that so many people have wanted for so long, I think people are going to be inclined to support it. I think there's a couple potential pitfalls. First and foremost is, what are the variances? How big are these variances going to be? Is it a significant change over what's already approved? You know, if they come in and they ask for 60 feet, I could see that being an issue. But if it's a couple feet, I think 40 feet is the zoning limit. If it's a couple feet over that, then people will probably be more likely to, you know, to approve it. There's also this question of what to do. So if you go to this park, it's called Willoughby Park. Some remains from this 1947 chairlift are still there. They have this big old, it's called the bullwheel structure, which turned the lift, sort of a big steel and wooden thing that's sitting right there. There's a couple of the old towers.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's cool. It's something that really is, it's sort of something that belongs in a museum.
Yeah.
And the city wants to keep that there and incorporate that into the site plan next to this new lift. And we're not sure the details on how that's going to work out. Some people have said, you know, is it really worth it to have all this old stuff there if it's a better, you know, if it's a more functional plan to move it? So there's a lot of debate to be had about that. That, you know, that's really important to people who are very passionate and knowledgeable about Aspen history.
Yeah, right. Well, it sounds like it's sort of like the bottom of the ninth for this project.
I'd say we're like the seventh inning stretch.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, we look forward to your reporting in the future as the game comes to a close. Let's take another quick break and we'll be right back. You're listening to Valley Roundup on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Wyatt Orme. Giving us the backstory today are Curtis Wackerly, editor-in-chief of the Aspen Daily News, Tatiana Flowers, reporter for the Post-Independent, and Aspen Public Radio's arts and culture reporter, Kristen Kay. I'm your host, Wyatt Orme. So Kristen, peak season, summer is on the way, and lots of people are going to be coming to this valley to enjoy everything it has to offer. There are a few things that have caught your eye in the arts and culture world that have maybe a little more somber messages, maybe. Can you talk about those?
You kind of make me sound like a fun hater.
You're not a fun hater. I know you're not.
I think maybe the word meaty is better. That there are things coming that people will be able to chew on a little bit. And like, of course, it's entertainment galore this summer. There's food and wine. There's festivals. There's amazing music. But there is also a lot going on that is meant to just stir thought and conversation in audiences. So first, Ai Weiwei, a Chinese dissident and artist and a filmmaker, his film Human Flow, his documentary about the refugee crisis, was actually at the Temporary last month or earlier this spring. Mm-hmm. And he'll be at Anderson Ranch in mid-July. And then Mohsen Hamid, his novel Exit West, which is also about the refugee crisis, it kind of puts a magical realism twist on it. Mm-hmm. He was just honored by Aspen Words with their first literary prize, and he'll be kind of headlining Aspen Summer Words this summer, so he'll be here. But other social issues, like really all across the board, are being tackled.
Let me ask quickly, though. I mean, do you think it's just a coincidence that you have these two very well-known artists whose work, you know, has to do with the refugee crisis coming at the same time? Or do you think that organizations here in the Valley are responding to kind of the broader national and international conversation that's going on right now?
Well, I think that there are going to be such a range of social issues being tackled. I think that it just shows that our arts organizations in this Valley, they want to stir conversations. Like, they want to, of course, have people come through the doors and have a great time, but also they want to give some food for thought. And I think they know that here they have pretty sophisticated audiences who mm-hmm. who expect that. I also think that, look, right now in the art world, all kinds of different artists are responding to a pretty tumultuous time globally and in our country. And a lot of work being produced right now is just tackling some tough topics or mm-hmm. issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I think it's fair to kind of remind listeners that that, you know, here the Aspen Skiing Company, their kind of most recent branding initiative, the Aspen Way, had a much more kind of social kind of bent to it than maybe people were expecting.
Right. I mean, it's everywhere. It's going to be like at the Aspen Art Museum this summer. There's an exhibit called Girls Plus Veils by Cheryl Donegan, and she's a feminist artist. She's like a critic of consumer culture, and she'll have paintings, and then it's kind of a fashion show in a way that will be there. So some messages there. And then it's not just artists coming in from the outside. The Wheeler is currently closed for some renovations, but the first show when they reopen is going to be something called Newtopia, which is created by a local, Lauren Wilder, and it's going to be this crazy multimedia kind of theater production centered on the messages of love from the Beatles.
Nice.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a ton of fun. But Jenna Bueller, I talked to her, and she's actually hoping, she's like, look, we spend so much time and money bringing in artists from the outside, but we have incredible talent here locally. And they're hoping to really start partnering with more local artists, which I think is interesting. So it's really all over. Like, even earlier this spring, Thunder River Theater Company in Carbondale, they had a production of Emperor's New Clothes, which was geared toward kids and families, but it was political satire. The Emperor had a large orange wig is all I'm saying. So really, like, this kind of like art with a message is going to be all over the place this summer, and I think even beyond.
Yeah, right. And it's not as if the summer doesn't bring plenty of kind of hard hitting conversations to the Aspen, you know, area with the Ideas Festival and so on and so forth.
And Security Forum is here as well. But I think that these events from our arts organizations are a little bit different because the mediums are different. It's not just like but it's beyond conversations on a stage, and that artists are using different mediums of theater or visual art to help kind of stir conversation.
Okay. Do you know how long Ai Weiwei will be here?
Not that long. I think just 3 days. Three days at Anderson.
Three days. And then he was also most recently at the temporary, his video was shown at the temporary.
Yeah. And then there was a live webcast of him answering questions. This was like kind of a national event that his documentary was screened all over the nation. And then he took questions from audiences. So he was there in spirit, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there anything else that you have your eye on this coming summer as far as arts and culture stuff up and down the valley?
Things
that people can get ready for?
My gosh, I think that there's going to be a ton going on, not just in Aspen, but also in Basalt and Carbondale. I really think, I mean, the temporary has been kind of a game changer for Mid-Valley. Uh-huh. And people who live Mid-Valley don't necessarily need to or don't necessarily anymore travel up to Aspen for entertainment. There's going to be a lot going on there, just right outside their door. So that's interesting that we have a ton of options all up and down the valley.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, I think that that's going to do it for Valley Roundup for this week's Valley Roundup. Thank you so much, Tatiana, for joining us. Tatiana Flowers with the Post-Independent. Curtis Wackerly, Editor-in-Chief of the Aspen Daily News and Aspen Public Radio's very own Kristen Kay. I'm Wyatt Orme. I'm your host this week. I'm also a reporter here at Aspen Public Radio. If you'd like to see anything from our show again, if you'd like to hear any part of our show again or see any of the articles, the topics that we covered, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Thanks so much for listening. Valley Roundup is a production of Aspen Public Radio News. Tune in to Aspen Public Radio on Tuesday at 3:30 for our latest installment of Spotlight Health 2018. It's a six-part series in partnership with the Aspen Ideas Festival and the Spotlight Health Conference. Each week, host Allison Bektash talks with leading researchers, business people, and others about their discoveries in health and medicine.